Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chat's Books. Today we're examining the complex relationship between China and the rest of the world with Oliver Letwin, former MP and member of the National Security Council, as well as many other things besides. His book, China vs. America, looks at the evolving status of China in the modern world and why we should be taking it a bit more seriously. Welcome.
Oliver Letwin, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Hello.
We're here to talk about your book, China vs. America, which is out shortly. And by the time the podcast is out, will also be out. I just wanted to kind of get started by your book is basically an examination of China's rise to, you know, political, economic power or increasing power and the way that's affecting its relationships, as I understand it, with the West, especially the US and the UK. You know, as a seasoned political operator, kind of what inspired you to write about this subject?
Well, I was very much involved in going back and forth to China and working on our policy on China in the years 2010 to 2016, when I was a minister in the cabinet office and I was part of the National Security Council. And when I ceased to be a minister and had more time on my hands, I thought I really must try to find out why all the things that I could see going on were going on and what was likely to happen next. And that gave rise to 5 years of effort, which made me think that the situation is indeed extremely worrying.
When you say you went to China quite frequently as part of your job, what was the experience of going there? Do you find it quite different to the West? I suppose it is different, but like, how did you find it very strikingly different in people's attitudes and the way they viewed the West?
Well, the first thing is that you going to China at any time in the recent past, you can't fail to be impressed by the evidence all around you of a colossal achievement in terms of economic growth, infrastructure. I mean, just very, very impressive buildings. You know, in the time it's taken us to talk about 100 kilometers of high-speed rail, they built 18,000 kilometers of it. I traveled on it all over the place. It's, you know, the whole timbre of pace of change is extraordinary. Shenzhen, which I had seen many years previously as a sort of fishing village on the other side of the water from Hong Kong, is now a massive glistening city. You just can't fail to be impressed by the scale of the economic achievement. The other thing which is very clear is talking to people in China, and this comes across both in the polling evidence that's been done and just anecdotally, is that ordinary Chinese people do really feel that they're going in the right direction, despite it being an authoritarian, repressive socialist market regime that has a dreadful human rights record. Actually, most Chinese people think it's improved their lives. I think that's pretty clear. And the third thing is that you can't fail to be impressed by the growing sense of importance and growing self-confidence of the people running China. And you're aware also of considerable suspicion of the West, which is not wholly surprising, given that for 250 years after some millennia of China being one of the great economic and political powers of the world, the Western powers engaged in aggressive imperialism and colonialism and fought really quite disgraceful opium wars to try and sell forced opium on the Chinese, for example. So there was a period of 250 years when China was no longer significant because of the West having had an industrial revolution that they didn't, and the West took advantage of that. So there is a history that inevitably makes for some considerable mistrust. There's also, I think, you get a sense of the wariness in China of all foreigners, and indeed most of the rest of the world, I think, if you travel around it, consists of people who are quite wary of China. So there's a background here of mutual mistrust, which I'm afraid is the background against which the present dangers that we face are being faced.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite interesting to hear you say, obviously, that there just seems to be this massive disconnect between China and the West and how they view each other and how they view themselves. Do you feel like with China, especially because of, like you said, the Opium Wars and stuff like that, there's a resentment towards the West? Or is it more like there's a feeling that they're taking their like natural place in the world now, having kind of, you know, had this massive empire which then fell and is now kind of rising again?
Well, I think both. There's the self-confidence and sometimes the rather unfortunate aggressiveness associated with a renewed sense of their own power. And there is a mistrust based on resentment, historical resentment. And I think, you know, if you travel to Washington and talk to people there, right across the political spectrum and right across the various parts of the establishment, you get a very strong sense that there is an equal and opposite problem, which is that people in Washington really do believe that America ought to be leading the world alone, whereas it's very clear talking to people of influence in power in China that they believe that the world is now a sort of G2 world in which they are the other superpower and that they need to be taken that way. And so there is a real conflict of self-image, if you like, between how people see China in Beijing and how Americans see America in Washington.
Talking about China expanding its influence and becoming more confident on the world stage, like how exactly is it going about doing that? Because we've all kind of heard, you know, wolf warrior diplomacy, that kind of thing, and an increasing willingness to kind of expand their borders. What kind of approach are they taking to becoming more dominant globally?
Well, I chart in the book the very many steps that they're taking. A great part of it, of course, is through the extension of their economic power. The Belt and Road Initiative is a massive series of investments globally in everything you can imagine, which has had the effect of giving the Chinese party and government an enormous amount of influence in many parts of the world, in Africa and other parts of Asia, indeed in Central Asia and increasingly in areas like Afghanistan, where tragically we now see that the Chinese beginning to exert influence as we leave and the Taliban take over. But it's not just economic influence. They've also built an extremely impressive array of interlocking diplomatic institutions centered on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There are 9 or 10 of these organizations now, which at the center of which lie China, Russia, and India, locked in an uneasy mutual embrace. And they exert very considerable influence through that network. And they're also extremely active in other forms of soft power, for example, through the United Nations and all its bodies. They were canny enough to notice that the subsidiary agencies of the UN, things like the World Health Organization in Geneva, rather than the central organization, the Security Council and the General Assembly and so on in Washington, New York, were sort of ripe for the picking, and they have used a huge amount of influence over other member states to acquire a position of very considerable influence in those UN organizations. So wherever you look, what you see is China not just expanding its military power and its sheer economic scale and its production and its technology and its infrastructure, but also its diplomatic reach and its degree of influence and investment in the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And that thing you were saying about the UN was quite interesting, because I believe maybe a few days ago in the Times, there was a piece on how China had also kind of exerted its influence on the WHO to kind of impact or influence the way that it was looking into the origins of the coronavirus. Do you think that, you know, the COVID could, or China saw that as its opportunity to kind of, I guess, vault onto the world stage or gain more influence?
Well, I don't think it's a question of COVID having led it to think that it could exert more influence. The Chinese had begun already to exert very considerable influence in many of the international organizations, of which the WHO was one, and that from their point of view certainly did pay what they would regard as dividends in the way that the WHO didn't criticize the Chinese regime when, for a couple of weeks, the regional authorities in Wuhan were trying to bury the news, and the central authorities, once they did begin to hear of it, also tried to bury the news before they released the genome sequencing and admitted what was going on. And so, I mean, you have in the origins of COVID, you have all the cocktail of things that make our world currently so dangerous. We can't tackle pandemics in the world today without the cooperation with the Chinese. It's increasingly difficult to get that cooperation because of the very difficult relationship between the US and China. They have an enormous amount of influence over the international bodies and an enormous amount of influence in many other parts of the world over their health systems, which they've been very determinedly subsidizing and investing in. And because they have a repressive regime, but one of the things they're bad at is having open information flows. I mean, none of us is perfect about this, but they're particularly bad at it because the penalties for admission of malfeasance or ineptitude in China are much greater than here, because we don't imprison people or shoot them and they make administrative errors. Whereas in China, the penalties are very great for getting it wrong. So people don't like to admit it. And the result is that there is not always an immediate information flow when things really do go wrong. So you have here all the sort of cocktail of things which mean that a sort of set piece encounter in a sort of proto-Cold War between China and the US looks more and more likely. And it's all demonstrated at the beginning of COVID, where President Trump then labeled it the China virus, playing on all the mistrust of China and the West. And the Chinese retaliated with absurd theories about the United States' role in COVID, a sort of diplomatic global shouting match that got no one anywhere at a time when we desperately needed to cooperate.
With Trump coming to power, like you were saying, there's this, do you believe that we are heading for a Cold War type situation then?
Well, I think the worrying thing is it was not just a Trump phenomenon, and I don't think it's just Xi either. I think these mutual degrees of mistrust between China and America, and this conflict of views about whether America ought to lead the world or whether the leading of the world has to be shared between America and China, are now baked in on either side institutionally. So when President Biden replaced President Trump, although the tone of voice became more sedate and serious, actually the message wasn't very different. I don't think if and when she is replaced by whoever replaces him, whenever that is, it's very likely that their message will be very different either, as things currently stand. So I don't think this is one leader versus another. I think this is one system versus another, and that's what makes it's so difficult at the moment to envisage anything other than an increasing degree of Cold War. And I think we desperately need to get out of that modality. And the only way I can see of getting out of it, given that the UN and the rest of the international system really don't work very well, is to try to cooperate on specific things like the pandemic, like climate change, like food security, energy security, water security, all sorts of issues of enormous common concern, which we can't resolve without both America and its allies and China being involved in the cooperation. We ought to be getting to work on all of those in order to try to build up some degree of trust in areas where we can do business, because they're not questions of ideology or conflicting values. They are clearly common problems that need common resolutions.
Yeah, for sure. And then to dig into that a little bit more deeply, then you say that the current system we have is flawed and, you know, there's a bit of a stalemate. Like, what kind of new system should we be hoping to put in place instead to make sure that we can all cooperate more effectively?
Well, the argument I make in this book is that we really shouldn't try to think of this in terms of systems. Trying to reform the global international order so-called rules-based order of the UN and its connected and affiliated organizations, which is often talked about, I think is a mug's game. I don't believe we're going to succeed in turning that whole array of organizations into something totally different from what it was originally created as, which was essentially a vehicle for the dominance of the United States and its allies after the end of the Second World War. I don't think the UN actually did a particularly good job in the last Cold War. We came within an inch of mutual obliteration. It wasn't the UN that got us past that. I don't think it's going to play any significant role, whatever one tries to do with it, in resolving this new dawning Cold War with China. I think we have to deal with this case by case and subject by subject. And as I say, I think things like the Conference of Parties number 26 in Glasgow on climate change and what flows from that, and cooperation on climate change, cooperation to deal with in new ways with not just the WHO, tackling global health issues, indeed cooperation in relation to food and agriculture and antimicrobial resistance, which is another major problem for the world, but also cooperation in more mundane ways on crucial issues that aren't going to go away, like, you know, how do we deal with the fact that with climate change, which is happening, we are going to face significant water shortages around the world. How do we manage that? And I think these things have to be addressed through specific efforts on the part of the West to find means of cooperating with the Chinese to address locally and pragmatically things where both China and the West have, and indeed the rest of the world, have a significant interest in getting them resolved. And maybe as we do that without worrying about systems, we will gradually be able to accumulate a better understanding of one another and a better degree of trust in one another. And that might, many, many years later, perhaps, both lower the temperature of the encounter and lead to the possibility of some systemic change. But I wouldn't start with that.
Yes, for sure. And, you know, with stuff like climate change, it really is something that does require a global effort to solve, especially as the two sides on the, you know, the two opposing sides, effectively the US and the China are the world's biggest polluters. There's no solution that doesn't involve both of them.
Exactly so.
And so to turn our focus onto the UK for a second then, you're saying obviously we need some new kind of way of dealing with China, of improving our relation with China. What is the UK government's current attitude towards China or way of dealing with China?
Well, I'm not sure that the UK government at the moment has any particular attitude to China. It appears to be wandering around in the mists rather, sometimes taking rather aggressive actions as over Huawei, sometimes appearing to be more emollient. I don't think, to tell you the truth, that the UK is much of a player in all of this. We're not, contrary to the illusions that some of our fellow citizens harbour, we're not one of the world's great powers, and I don't think we can make a significant impact on this directly. I think we do still have some degree of influence, one shouldn't overstate it, over the way that the United States behaves, and I think we have some residual influence over the way that the European Union behaves. And indeed some, although again it shouldn't be overstated, some degree of influence over the way in which people in English-speaking countries elsewhere in the world, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and so on, and indeed even to some extremely limited extent in India behave. And the Indians, of course, are a very important part of all of this. So I think if we were to make a significant, sustained, strategic, bipartisan and hence continuous diplomatic effort to influence all those parties in the direction that I'm describing, namely persistently to try to advocate closer cooperation with China in a suitably careful and eyes open kind of way in areas where we have common interests and need to do business for the sake of the whole world. I think if we were to adopt that strategy, it would have only a marginal effect, but it would have a productive effect. And if other European countries that also have some degree of influence were to join us in that. And indeed other G7 countries like Canada and other G20 countries like India were to join us in that endeavor, it might begin to have a significant influence on US policy, and that might in turn create more space and more incentive for the Chinese to begin to move in that direction too. There is a lively debate of this kind going on in China, just as there is in the West. And at the moment, we're just giving succor to the hardliners in Beijing. But if we were to gradually shift the whole world in the direction I'm describing, maybe China would come along. No one can't guarantee any such thing, but it might. So I think the UK's role is very much indirect and very small by minute by comparison with that of the United States or the EU or India, the great moving parts of our world. But nevertheless, we could have a constructive influence if, but only if we had a persistent, consistent, strategic diplomatic effort across many years.
Do you believe that the West is complacent when it comes to China?
I don't think it's a question of complacency so much. There certainly was a time not very many years ago when an awful lot of people, particularly in Europe, were trying to pretend that the Chinese weren't really ever going to get anywhere and weren't really very important. I think there are still small pockets of people who have persuaded themselves of this, in my view, evidently illusory proposition. But I think over the last very few years, actually, most people in the West have begun to recognize what people across the spectrum in the United States have certainly recognized, which is that China is an enormously important country now. Well on the way to being, by some measures already is, the world's largest economy, and well on the way to being the most powerful country in the world. And I think, therefore, it's not a question of complacency, it's a question of the attitude we adopt to that. Do we see them, because they have an authoritarian, repressive, market socialist regime, do we see them as enemies that have to be contained in a Cold War? Or do we see them as potentially cooperators in resolving the great issues of the world, notwithstanding the fact that we don't approve of the way they run their own country? And I think that's the big debate that's going on at the moment.
Yes, for sure. And I think that debate has certainly led to a few mixed messages when it comes to dealing between China and the West. Like, what do you think are in terms of maybe UK-US foreign policy with China, what do you think are the biggest blunders we've had in dealing with China?
Well, I think it's been basically one blunder after another. I don't think there's really anything other than blunders recently, because there's been no real sustained effort to resolve this issue. If the intention of the US had been to move progressively towards a position in which we entered a full-scale Cold War and thereafter, very possibly a hot war, a conflagration, then all the moves that have been made would make some kind of sense. I don't actually believe that most of the people engaged in the activities that they are engaged in Washington or indeed across the West as a whole want that result. I think we're sleepwalking into it through ineptitude and misunderstanding, and through a persistent illusory belief that America can go on being the leader of the world without reference to China, or without more than a nodding reference to China, and that somehow we can disengage from China, punish China, bully China into some kind of submission. And I think as long as that's the sort of underlying theme of Western policy, it'll just go on making one mistake after another. The only excuse for the direction of current Western policy would be if what we're really trying to do is to limber up to try to win a war, a hot war. Personally, I think the idea that our policy should be directed toward maximizing the chance of winning a massive confrontation with China is highly irresponsible for my children and grandchildren. I think the fate of the world, if that would happen, would not be a good one. And therefore, I think we should direct our policy towards avoiding that, and hence trying not to slip into a Cold War while maintaining certainly a high degree of realism about the fact that these are very powerful people with their own interests that they're very determined to follow.
Yes, and what you were saying about the West not choosing to believe that China isn't a threat or thinking they can bully them into submission is certainly the kind of viewpoint of a country and civilization that's used to being at the top, perhaps, and not used to having any competition. Looking forward to the future in that case, what moves can we expect to see from China in the next 20 years? Where do you think it's going to try and expand its influence? We kind of know it's, you know, making inroads into Africa. Do you think that kind of empire building is going to continue?
Well, I think there are two sides to this. There's the question, is China likely to aim at, is it currently aiming at global domination in the way that Napoleon or indeed in Chinese history, Genghis Khan or Stalin or Hitler aimed? And on that side of the question, I have to say, I don't think there's any evidence at all that China is aiming at destroying Western liberal democracies and taking over the running of the entire world on an imperial basis. There have been regimes that did try to do that in world history. And indeed, one of them, briefly, the Yuan dynasty under Genghis Khan and his successors in China, but just for a century or so out of several millennia, did try to do that. According to the ways you could do it at the time. Obviously, they didn't have nuclear weapons and aircraft carriers and ballistic missiles, but they had other weapons, and they used them, and they did try and, under those circumstances at that time, try to establish themselves as a near global power as they could get. But that is a brief period, and it leaves you with the other sort of three millennia of Chinese history, during the whole of which vast efforts were made at control of China itself and of its borders and peripheries, but no effort was made to invade and control the rest of the world. And I think that is the broad mindset, not just what Chinese current leaders say, but actually what Chinese current leaders think. I don't think they have an ambition to rule the world any more than the United States does as a direct imperial power. We are past, I think, the period of these sort of vast imperialisms. I do think, on the other hand, the second part of the question, that there are all sorts, I try to illustrate them and go into some detail on them in the book, of flashpoints around the world where at the borders of China, China has both a very strong and very Chinese view of what things ought to look like, and where that's very much in distinction to what other people the other side of those borders think. So China is, notwithstanding its considerable diplomatic links with India, is actually continuously skirmishing with India in the Himalayas, which are, with climate change, the source of one of the great frictions of the world, because they are the source of water, essentially, for people on both sides. Millions and millions of people on both sides of the Himalayas depend on the Himalayas for water, and who controls the Himalayas as water shortages begin to be one of the most important geopolitical facts will be absolutely critical. Similarly, with climate change, there's a massive exposure of Bangladesh's waters rise to tens of millions of people migrating. The Indians are currently running the world's largest militarized border around Bangladesh to prevent those people moving into Calcutta with a quarter of a million troops or so and orders to shoot. In the South China Sea, the East China Sea, in Central Asia, where you can look in lots of parts of the world which surround China, which has an enormously long set of borders. And what you find everywhere, really, is causes of potential friction with the Russians, with the Indians, with the Japanese, with the Taiwanese, with the neighbors in the South China Sea, Vietnam and the Philippines and so on. And each of those could become a flashpoint, because in all those cases, one can envisage ways in which the United States could begin to feel that it, stroke NATO, ought to be taking the part of someone on the other side of whichever border it is we're talking about. So while I don't think that there's any serious risk at the moment that the Chinese have in mind to subvert Western liberal democracies and take over the world and run it as an empire. I do think that we need to think extraordinarily carefully about how to deal with all these frictions at the borders. However, my strong conclusion of as a result of the work I've done over the past few years is that trying to tackle those head on at the moment is not going to be productive because the relationship is too bad. And that's why I think we have to tackle this sideways and try to develop some degree of ability to talk more constructively with the Chinese and cooperate with the Chinese in much less contentious fields where we have common interests rather than conflict. And only after a number of years of building that up do I think there might be a chance of actually finding ways to talk about and hence to diffuse some of these very, very vexed issues at China's borders.
Yes, absolutely. And you've wrapped up very neatly, but in case there's anything you wanted to add, is there, what is one thing you hope people should take away from reading your book?
That we are currently headed towards Cold War and perhaps Hot War. This is not a good idea, and we should try to build some way out of it by cooperating on areas of mutual interest across the world.
Yes, the future is very much in flux. So we can expect to follow up, I imagine, China versus America part two in the next decade or so. Oliver Letwin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If hearing Oliver's thoughts on China and its relationship with the West has piqued your interest, then why not take a look at his book, China versus America? It's out now and available from all good bookshops. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.